uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, on WhiteRoseSociety.org, on CRN Digital. Welcome to our program. Joe Andrews is a lawyer, former election official. In 2000, was the national chair of the Democratic National Committee. He now is an attorney, works for Diebold Election Systems, among others. He's actually with the firm of Sonenshein, and Sonenshein, Knath, and Rosenthal, LLP. Is that right, Joe?
Just another example of how astute you are that you could get the whole name. It's great to be on your show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being here, Joe. You were chairman of the Democratic National Committee at the time of the meltdown, the election meltdown in 2000.
I was. And to tell you, that was a life-altering experience, I think, for all of us who were there and saw the presidency, of course, from my perspective, you know, taken away from Al Gore by a whole series of processes and problems down there that needed to be fixed, some of which have, probably more importantly, some of which haven't.
Well, one of the most important being that John Roberts flew down to Florida and advised a whole bunch of lawyers as to how to argue before the Supreme Court that the vote should not actually be counted in Florida. But that's not what you wanted to come on and talk about.
Oh, well, but I'm happy to talk about that, as you can imagine, as well. It is outrageous, and I'm certainly proud to be part of the group of people that are, you know, urging a no vote on John Roberts for that and many other reasons too. So many of these things are related. We've been spending so much time today talking about the failures of the administration, because down in New Orleans and in Mississippi and now on the coast towards Texas, and I was reminded as I just spoke to the group of Secretary of States about how the vital records in the entire state of Louisiana were all kept right in New Orleans, swept away by that water, making it almost impossible, for example, to have any kind of verified voting in Louisiana for these important elections that are coming up. They've got an election for mayor, for example, just in February down there. And because of my experience that happened in 2000, I've spent the past 4 years, you know, speaking out about trying to make sure that we can have voting systems that are accessible for the disabled, that for people that would choose to vote in a language other than English, that it's easier to vote in some way that you feel comfortable and secure voting as well. I know my parents, who are getting up there in years, have trouble reading small print on some things, and so being able to make sure that if you are elderly, that you have an ability to vote in a way that you feel comfortable and confident in. And because of that, as one of the fewer liberal voices here speaking out on the importance of those things as well, obviously a lot of these equipment manufacturers, you know, found me and have always asked me to try to assist them in this process. You've mentioned one of them in your introduction here as well.
Well, that's in fact, that came with your bio, was yes, that you're representing Diebold. And this is the thing that baffles me, Joe, and it's the thing where I just don't get it. Or maybe you don't. And we'll figure it out here. The commons, there's this concept of the commons that both the Democratic and the Republican Party over the years have historically championed, that there are some things that are so vital that we want to absolutely maintain control over them. For example, our fire departments. We used to have privatized fire departments in the United States. And you would have to buy a medallion from the local fire company. You'd have to pay them monthly or pay them annually a fee for that. And if your house caught on fire and you had the wrong medallion nailed to the front of your house or no medallion, the fire trucks would just go right on by.
Yes.
And we figured out that wasn't such a good idea. In fact, Ben Franklin actually figured that out. He put the first public fire company together in Philadelphia back in the late 1700s, or actually the mid 1700s. But, you know, it didn't propagate all the way across the United States until really the last 110 years or so, and particularly after the Chicago fire. And so, you know, there are these things that are the commons, the fire departments, the police departments. We don't want we don't want Blackwater Security patrolling our cities. You know, we want a police department that's accountable to us. We don't want our government to be, for example, working for private corporations. We don't want our you know, we have an elected government. They work for us. They don't work for GE. They work for us. So the commons, our air, our water, our public school systems, our roads, our traffic signs, all of that stuff, these are the things the government actually does well. And the way that that we administer the commons is by electing our elected representatives. You with me so far?
I'm with you.
Okay. Why then, if all of this is so sacred, and if the whole point of government is to administer the commons, why then would we privatize the most critical part of the commons of government itself, government being the commons by which the commons are administered, why would we privatize the way that we tell the government what our will is, that is the vote? Why on God's earth would we want to privatize? Why would we want a private corporation, not answerable to us, but answerable to the shareholders of Diebold, the people who are paying your check? Why would we want them telling us how we voted and telling us that we have no damn right to know how they counted that vote because it's a trade secret?
Tom, you're absolutely right. We shouldn't. And more importantly, though, of course, we don't. Just like those fire departments have to go out and buy fire trucks that are produced by General Motors and Ford, the election systems here are run by elected officials. They're run by secretary of states. They're run by county commissioners. They set the rules. They set the programs. And since the beginning of...
Wait a second. That's not true, Joe.
Well, actually, it is true. Now, we may want to have a national program.
I don't know. You know, I know several county commissioners, and I'm pretty good friends with the attorneys or the secretaries of state of two different states, and none of them write the programs that run on these computers. None of them. Not one.
Well,
you just said they set the programs. They do not. The programs are written by Diebold, by ESNS, by Sequoia, and they're written in secret. And when the Secretary of State, two different Secretaries of State that I know of have asked these companies, may we please see the source code? They were told, no, it's none of your damn business.
Well, that's a federal issue too, as well, Tom. I'm agreeing with you here. If you just give me a second, there's no question about it that I agree with you completely that we should need to have as much a public control and public input into every single portion of this process. But just as our public fire departments go out and buy fire equipment from people, we've always gone out and bought election equipment. The question is making sure that election equipment meets the standards that we, the public, care about, and as you point out, not any individual company or individual private organization, and making it as public as possible is something that I certainly support. I'm trying to make sure that we can do in this process is have standards that guarantee just those kinds of things. You know, the biggest problem we have, Tom, is that each individual county here has got a different standard. They each going to define differently what they may want to have, whether it's from the software we're talking about or the actual machine, the equipment. That makes it harder and harder for you and me and the public to know whether or not those equipment is doing what we want it to do, which is to accurately and securely count the vote and to make sure that people, regardless of what disabilities they may have or what language they want to vote in, have access to it so that they themselves can get to the vote. In this complicated system we have, that's what's complicated, and that's clearly, I think, what you're talking about and what we need to address.
We're talking with Joe Andrews. He's with Sonnenheim Nathan Rosenthal, a law firm and lobbying firm, and you guys work for Diebold. Joe, you're not answering my question. I don't disagree that governments have to buy things. I mean, you know, governments buy paperclips from paperclip manufacturers. You don't go out and make public companies to manufacture paperclips. They buy ballpoint pens. They buy computers. They buy printers. What I'm suggesting is that the software that runs on these machines, I have no problem with Diebold making voting machines, and I have no problem with governments buying voting machines from Diebold. The problem I have is with the actual counting of the vote. Once it's being done on silicon, that counting of the vote is no longer being done by human beings. It's out of sight, and it's being done in secret. And the actual counting of the vote is a function of the software. And your company, the company that you represent, wants to tell me and all of us that we have no right to see how that vote is counted.
Oh, that's not true, Tom. You know that's not true. Let's back up here.
Then why doesn't Diebold support open source software, Joe?
Whether or not there's an open source code or not, as you know, is controlled by the federal process here, the federal election.
And the federal process is being driven by the corporation that's writing paychecks to you.
They're not writing paychecks to me. I do represent a lot of people, and I've been very upfront about how I represent them too here, Tom. But I'm not here trying to defend them. I'm trying to here talk about the entire process here and how we've got to try to fix it as well. To get what you want, we obviously need a change in federal legislation. A change, as you just heard me say, I happen to support. But the federal government here, through the Help America Vote Act, through the Election Assistance Commission, has set up a system here that has individual companies producing this machinery and producing it to individual standards that different states and different counties themselves set. If a county,
right, and it's a mess.
If a county or state,
I agree with you. It's a mess.
if a county or state says we want to have open source code and demands it, they say, look, we're only going to buy equipment here that has open source code, they can do that.
But nobody will sell it to them.
It's not the election machine.
Nobody will sell it to them, Joe.
Pardon?
Nobody will sell it to them.
Well, no, I believe me, I bet I guarantee you that there any one of these companies in the business would sell it to them.
That's the thing. I mean, when Diebold comes along and says, okay, we support the development of open source code, and, you know, let's go at it, let's do the Linux of voting software, then, you know, I might change my mind on this. But, Joe, I appreciate you coming on. And
thanks, Tom. Next time we'll actually kind of get to some of the reality of this stuff. I want to come back.
Okay, well, if you don't think we're at the reality of it, hang on. We'll come back after this break. It's 17 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Folks in Florida cast their votes as all good citizens do. In West Palm Beach, the ballot read to vote for one punch two. Once you punch it again, give it another good push. You thought you voted for Gore, surprise, you cast your ballot for Bush. In Florida, the sun is shining. It's early bird dining and early to bed. The Republican said stop the counting. Gore's total and mounting. Let's quit while we're ahead.
And welcome back, my friends. It is 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Howard Dean and Bev Harris on Topic A with Tina Brown.
Bev sat me down, and in a few short seconds, I was amazed at what I could do.
All right, Bev, show me how to do this.
Well, what we have here is the central tabulator computer. Now, in a voting system, you have all these different voting machines at all the different polling places. Sometimes, as in a county like mine, there's 1,000 polling places in one county. All those machines feed into the one machine so it can add up all the votes. So, of course, if you were going to do something you shouldn't to a voting machine, would it be more convenient to do it to the 4,000 machines or to just come in here to one machine and deal with all of them at once? What surprises people is the central tabulator is just a PC. It's like you and I use. It uses Windows. It's just a regular computer.
So anybody who can hack into a PC can hack into the central tabulator.
The GEMS program is the program that is the central tabulator program. And I'm going to put in a password here.
For Diebold.
Okay, we're in. Now, this is the official program that the county supervisor sees.
Is
up
this
to
the Diebold program?
Yes, this is a Diebold central tabulation program.
Okay.
And then go to election summary report. And it's kind of wear and spin for a minute while it adds up all the votes from all the different precincts. And you can see here, Howard Dean has 1,000 votes. And Lex Luthor has 500, so you're beating Lex Luthor, and we're...
2-1.
Yes, and Tiger Woods, unfortunately, doesn't have any votes yet.
All right.
All right, let's close this out. I was just showing you a way to go in and look at votes, which,
all
of
right.
course, you can't tamper with. Go to the Start menu, and I'm going to show you something tricky. And I want you to go to My Computer and just click that.
How to hack a Diebold machine.
And you're going to see some... Go to Local Disk C. Go to GEMS, which is the name of the Diebold program. You're going to go to LocalDB, which stands for Local Database. That's where they keep the votes. And by the way, this has been out on the Internet for ages now. Go to Central Tabulator Votes, which is the database we just looked at. And then go to the sum of the candidates, which is that table. You see, we have 800 votes here for you and 400 for Lex Luthor. Let's just flip those. We'll make that 400. And we'll give 100 votes to Tiger. Let's just see what happened here. We'll go back into GEMS the legitimate way. You're the county supervisor. You're checking on the progress of your election. And as you can see now, Howard Dean only has 500 votes. Lex Luthor has 900 and Tiger Woods has 100 votes. Mm. We just edited an election. It took us 90 seconds.
And it's untraceable. And we're talking to Joe Andrews. He's a lawyer with Sonnensheim, sonnensheim.com, and working for Diebold. And Joe, what am I missing here? To use your fire analogy, you said, you know, fire departments buy their fire trucks from General Motors. Isn't, though, an election machine company owning the software the same thing as saying, okay, as if a fire truck manufacturer said, yeah, you can buy our fire trucks, but by the way, you've got to pay us for all the water that flows through them, and we get to control whether or not the water flows.
Each one of the programs and the software on every single electronic voting machine, including those we've been using for more than 25 years here, Tom, as you know, almost a third of Americans actually voted on electronic machines in 2004, and we've been doing it for about 25 years, has to go through a series of both federal tests as well as state tests. There's no secret to it. It's not as if it is hidden code. Every little bit of code has to go through those standards. First the federal qualification process, then the state process.
Actually, Joe, if I may correct you, tell me if you think I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm right on this. It's not the code itself that's examined by the federal government. It's the result of the code.
No, that's not true. They go through each one of them trying to make sure that
they go through every line of the code.
They're going to go through every line of the code. The debate has been whether or not they go through the lines of the code on the foundation systems. For example, if you build something on a Microsoft, panel, whether or not you're going to go through that or not as well.
I think you better check that out.
Most states now do require that, though, even when the federal government doesn't require that. Those standards obviously have been put in place. We've got 50-some million people here, and our communities representing 50-some million people. So, you get about half those people who actually vote, 25, 30 million people who vote on machines. Not a single case of votes being changed. Everybody, we got the all but my friends
say what?
In the media.
Say what? All these stories came out of Texas and Florida of people pushing the Al Gore button and the machine saying thank you for voting
and
for Bush. They just made those up?
The FBI and the Department of Justice, and everybody investigated every single one of these allegations, and it hasn't happened, Tom.
You investigated. Somebody says
why
it
didn't happen.
But there's no way to track it. There's no way to prove it.
Let me say why it didn't happen. It didn't happen because of the fact that election commissioners and election officials across America are fundamentally honest people. And while it's much easier to steal an election with old-fashioned paper ballots or with an old-fashioned lever machine, and there's plenty of examples of how elections have been stolen on these other types of voting in the past, fundamentally we've got good, honest people here that are reviewing
like Ken Blackwell
systems as well, trying to make sure that the things don't happen as well.
Joe, you're telling me Ken Blackwell's a good, honest guy?
I don't even know Ken Blackwell,
Kathleen Harris?
Not Ken Blackwell as well. But what I'm telling you about is that the county election processes are people who are reviewing and trying to protect these systems as possible. What Bev Harris is trying to demonstrate in front of Howard Dean is total fiction, right? Couldn't happen, didn't happen, obviously, in this process. The way that elections are stolen in America and the way the elections were stolen in Florida was by having processes in place where people's intention to vote a particular
for disenfranchising people. Yeah, well, I agree with you on that. Joe Andrews, thanks a lot for being with us. You make a good case. You're a good counselor. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 27 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like.
Not one bit.
Now you've been treating my stars and stripes.
No, you done wrong, George.
Took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. So I'm taking my country back.
There you go. Time to stand up and take back America.
And the treasury drawer, more than there had ever been before. But every day we're down and deeper in debt. Maybe 4 years should be all you get. Then you gave tax breaks to the millionaires. And you tried to make the working man pay. But you can't tax a man when his job's not there. Now look at where we are today.
There you go. And we're taking our country back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. And I just, Joe, you have to, on the one hand, honor somebody who's doing a job and who believes in what they're saying. And it is true. Fire departments buy fire trucks from for-profit corporations. And, we bought lever voting machines from for-profit lever machine-making voting machine companies for years and years. Nobody objected. And particularly if we ever go to instant runoff voting, IRV, nationwide, it becomes, ballots become much more complex. There's a lot of good reasons to have machines, to have technology in the voting process. But as I said, my concern is that the technology that controls the technology, the software that controls the hardware is closed source. It is proprietary. And I may be wrong, but I don't think I am. I believe that Joe was mistaken when he said that his client Diebold and other voting machine companies provide all of their source code line by line to the state and federal government to examine, because to the best of my knowledge, that is not happening. And I may be wrong, but I don't think so. And, you know, hopefully we can get on somebody who can let us know. But it's just a defective computer chip in the county's optical scanner misread ballots Tuesday night and incorrectly tallied a landslide victory for Republicans, announced the Associated Press in a story on November 7th of 2002, a few days after that election. The story added, now keep in mind, this voting machine said that the Republicans had won a landslide. The story added, Democrats actually won by wide margins. This is from the Associated Press. Republicans would have carried the day had not poll workers become suspicious when the computerized vote reading machine said the Republican candidate was trouncing his incumbent Democratic opponent in the race for county commissioner. The poll workers were close enough to their electorate, they were part of the electorate, to know their county overwhelmingly favored the Democratic incumbent. A quick hand recount of the optical scan ballots showed that the Democrat had indeed won, even though the computerized ballot scanning machines kept giving the race to the Republican. The poll workers brought the discrepancy to the attention of the county clerk, who notified the voting machine company. County Clerk Lindsay told the Associated Press, quote, a new computer chip was flown to Snyder, Texas from Dallas. With the new chip installed, the computer then verified that the Democrat had won the election. In another Texas anomaly, Republican State Senator Jeff Wentworth won his race with exactly 18,181 votes. Republican Carter Castile won her state House seat with exactly 18,181 votes. And conservative Judge Danny Scheel won his seat with exactly 18,181 votes, all in one county, Comal County. Apparently, however, no poll workers in Comal County thought to ask for a new chip. By the way, the first letter of the alphabet is a 1. The eighth letter of the alphabet is an H. 18,181, the number of votes that all three of these conservatives won by, if you make it into letters, becomes A-H-A-H-A-H, also known as... Yes. It's also, if you take, I believe it's 0.5 and divide by 1, it's, you know, a random number generator, the way of doing things. You come up with 18181881. So, could it be? Could it be? Who knows? USA Today reported on November 3rd, 2002, quote, in Georgia, an Atlanta Journal-Constitution poll shows Democratic Senator Max Cleland with a 49-44% lead over Republican Representative Saxby Chambliss. Cox News Service, based in Atlanta, reported just after the election, November 7th, 2002, that pollsters may have goofed. That's a quote from Cox News Service. Pollsters may have goofed. Because, quote, Republican Saxby Chambliss defeated incumbent Democratic Senator Max Cleland by a margin of 53-46%. The hotline, the political news service, recalled a series of polls Wednesday showing that Chambliss had been ahead in none of them, end quote. The entire state of Georgia voting on machines that produced no paper trail, no paper ballots. Just as amazing was the Georgia governor's race. Similarly, the Zogby polling organization reported on November 7th, no polls predicted the upset victory in Georgia. Republican Sonny Perdue over incumbent Democratic Governor Roy Barnes. Perdue won by a margin of 52-45%, whereas the most recent Mason-Dixon poll had shown Barnes, the Democrat, ahead 48-39% last month with a margin of error plus or minus 4 points, end quote. Nobody thought to ask for a new chip in Georgia, although it was noted on November 8th by the Atlanta Constitution Journal that in downtown Atlanta's predominantly Democratic Fulton County, quote, election officials said Thursday that memory cards from 67 electronic voting machines have been misplaced. So ballots cast in those machines are left out of previously announced vote totals, end quote. San Jose Mercury News, January 23rd, 2003, editorial titled, Gee Whiz, Voter Fraud? Quote, in one Florida precinct last November, votes that were intended for the Democratic candidate for governor ended up for Jeb Bush because of a misaligned touchscreen. How many votes were miscast before the mistake was found will never be known because there was no paper audit. End quote. Misaligned touchscreens also caused 18 known machines in Dallas to register Republican votes when Democratic screen buttons were pushed. It's unknown how many others were not noticed. And on it goes. 1-866-889-8894. Dave in Eureka, California. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom, I don't want to interrupt you. You're going really strong, making a case that I believe very much in myself, but I would want to lay out with you some of the logic that has me totally convinced. This has been an issue for me for several years now. I think Joe, the attorney, feels he believes in what he's saying. I think he has been lied to severely by Debo. Originally, you had Clint Curtis on this your program here, and he was contacted by GOP Tom Finney on behalf of Jeb Bush there.
Finney, yeah.
Yeah, Finney, to design a machine that would leave no...
No, to write a software module that could be inserted into a voting machine that would flip an election in an untraceable way. That's Clint Curtis's charge.
Could be accessed by an external modem.
And he's even posted that software that he wrote, by the way, on the Internet.
Yes. You know, several other things that just seemed to me so obvious. I know that right after the election, there were several precincts that had only 250 or 300 registered voters, most of them Democrats, that produced 5,000 to 6,000 votes for George Bush. Now, that doesn't, it's not possible.
Yeah,
but you can't go back and recount them because there's no record.
Yeah, and that's the ongoing problem, Dave. And I'm sure that, I can't speak for Joe, but my guess would be that a defender of the system would say, you know, well, okay, fine, let's build paper into the system, and, you know, or let's build paper ballots. That's still not enough for me. In my mind, we have to go beyond simply saying we need a paper receipt. In fact, we should never say we need a paper receipt, because all a receipt does... I mean, how many people do you know who read the receipt after they buy food at the supermarket? And yet every single year in every city I've ever lived in, there is always some local station that goes into a local supermarket and adds up the total from what it says on the shelf for what, you know, $100 worth of groceries is going to cost, goes and checks it out and discovers that when they scan the thing, some of those things are actually surprise, you're paying more for them than what it said on the shelf because they forgot to update their computer. Nobody ever checks their receipts. And besides that, how do you know if you get a receipt that it's telling you the way that the vote was actually recorded? No, what we need are actual paper ballots, number one. An actual paper ballot. And I have no problem with a computer being used basically as a fancy printer. Turn your voting machines into fancy printers and vote on the machine, and the machine then produces a paper ballot. And then the ballot can be scanned by another machine, as most of them are right now. But I would like that scanning software, the software that's actually counting the vote, to be open source software. To be like the Linux operating system, to be bulletproof. And to be bulletproof because every hacker in the country has had a say in how it was developed. Al in Greensburg, Indiana. Hey, Al, what's up?
I am one of three county election board officials in my little county here in Indiana. And the way that we do it here in Indiana, and by the way, Joe Andrew used to be our state chairman, we have the elected county clerk is the chairman of the election board, and then there's one Democrat and there's one Republican. Now, you know, depending on the county, that can be a very casual group of people. They're usually friends with one another. They're officially Democrats and officially Republicans, but, you know, a lot of times there's very little partisanship.
But really they're the old boy network?
Exactly. Yeah. But we do have a touch screen system. They are correct. We use a PC to count those. We have made very, very sure that that PC is never connected online anywhere. But none of us are computer experts. If the manufacturer of that machine comes in and programs that counting software at the end of the day, we really have no way of knowing whether that is totaling correctly or not. And we do get a paper printout. Our machines are made by an outfit in Indiana here called MicroVote. We do get a paper printout from each machine at the end of the day that we can verify with what's going into the computer. But again, if somebody has programmed item 1 to register 3 votes and item 2 to register 6 votes, we have no way of knowing whether that's
right.
Gone on or not.
So, Al, do you, as a county election board official, do you agree with my call for open source software? Is that the point?
Oh, absolutely. And the other way a paper receipt could be used is if a person could receive a paper receipt at the poll.
Al, I'm going to ask you to hold on because I got to take a break here. The computer, you know, it just runs. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich.
Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrow's where it ends. What we do today, don't stay the course on a horse that's going the wrong way.
Yes, indeed, my friends.
Horse that's going the wrong way.
Oh, don't ever do that. And of course, it ain't going to be a horse if it's ain't got anything to do with George W. Bush, because he's afraid of horses. That's why there's no horses at his so-called ranch. Anyhow, breaking news. Absolutely breaking news.
Now, the DeLay Political Death Watch.
Yes, Tom DeLay has been indicted on one count of criminal conspiracy by a grand jury in Texas. DeLay attorney Steve Britton said DeLay was accused of criminal conspiracy along with two associates, John Calandro, former executive director of a Texas political action committee formed by DeLay, I'm assuming that would be TRIMPAC, and Jim Ellis, who heads DeLay's National Political Committee. The Associated Press reports the indictment against the second-ranking and most assertive Republican leader came on the final day of the grand jury's term. It followed earlier indictments of a state political action committee founded by DeLay and three of his political associates. The grand jury action is expected to have immediate consequences in the House, where DeLay is largely responsible for winning passage of the Republican legislative program. House Republican Party rules require leaders who are indicted to temporarily set aside their leadership posts, although every little bit of scandal up to this point has not moved Tom DeLay off the dime. We'll see if this does. We were talking to Al. He's a county election board official in Greensburg, Indiana. Hey, Al, welcome back.
Hey, hallelujah on that news about Tom DeLay.
Yeah, it's a step-by-step. America's waking up to the fact that a corrupt gang of criminals and thieves, essentially, have taken over the governance of this nation, tragically, and we need to take it back. Anyhow, we were talking about electronic voting machines.
Well, I've been on the election board here for about 20 years, as has my Republican colleague, and we both agree that, you know, we're not computer experts. We can't really verify this stuff at all. And a good example, last year in Franklin County, Indiana, which is adjacent to us, they are very casual about the way they count votes, and apparently the Democratic chairman was hanging around in there while their card reader was working, and realized that all of a sudden there was an unusual vote count for the Libertarians. And he asked them to stop and examined a couple of ballots, which they allowed him to do, and they discovered that the program had, quote, accidentally been programmed so that all straight party Democrat votes would be counted as Libertarians, and all straight party Libertarian votes would be counted as Democrats. And as you might imagine, that would pretty well create an unusual number of Libertarian votes in this part of the world. But had he not been there, that would not have been noticed, and it actually caused several county races to switch sides.
Now, that same thing, by the way, or something like that must have happened in Florida, because there were a couple of counties in Florida where there were huge votes for the Libertarians, and the same thing in Ohio. I mean, the Libertarian candidate was one of the guys who was suing Ohio because he was saying, hey, I got more votes than I should have gotten.
And the machine manufacturer said, oh, it was just a glitch in that one county, no problem. And as far as I know, it was never examined further because the state election people are all appointed political hacks.
Yeah. Now, so, what would happen, Al, if you were to say to Diebold or to ES&S or Sequoia or any one of these voting machine companies, we would like to examine your software?
We would not be allowed to do so. We're simply told that everything that is sent down has been certified and approved by the state. That is clearly untrue, but the only thing that we can really check is if, you know, the number of voters that have shown up at the polls equals the number of votes cast. That would be the only thing
now,
that would be fishy.
Now you said Joe, our guest earlier, Joe Andrews, he used to be the chairman for your state. I'm assuming
right.
He's a decent guy.
Yeah, I mean, he's decent. My complaint with Joe when he was our state chairman is that his focus was on the larger cities in the state, and he ignored some of the smaller areas like ours. But
yeah,
he is a bona fide Democrat, and he did run for governor this last time and stepped aside when it was clear that the lieutenant governor was going to step up and run.
Yeah.
But one other comment that I did want to make, the one way that our machines are, if the state ever mandates that our machines that we bought are brand new, they are equipped to allow paper verification to come out of the machine. The way that you could control an election using that fairly would be that each person looks at their receipt, verifies that it was voted in the way they wanted, and then that receipt goes into a ballot box so that if there is a recount and the machine is way off, those paper receipts, which presumably each voter looked at and verified, could then be pulled to see if there were discrepancies.
Why not simply make the receipt the ballot itself? I mean, that's my argument, that we shouldn't be getting receipts, we should be getting ballots. Receipts create a sense of comfort when there may not be any. I'm concerned that the voting machine company says, oh, you want paper receipts? Sure, we'll give you paper receipts. And then everybody goes back to sleep.
Sure, exactly. And it's possible that receipt comes out with something that's completely erroneous.
Yeah. Yeah, and the point is, just because you got a receipt doesn't mean it actually happened. Al, thanks a lot for the call. Good
Thank
hearing
you.
From you. I appreciate it. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Jeff, we got about 45 seconds. What's up?
Basically, what your guest said was most was really wrong. I've been on the front lines of this for a long time. But key things we need to look at is we need, first of all, remember, it was certified stuff that caused the problems in Carteret County, North Carolina, and almost all around the country. It was certified stuff. I could go on and on about the certified. But what we need in the election is you need to count the paper ballot. We need discrete and unalterable ballots, and you need to go by how the vote is read, not how it's cast.
Right. In other words, you're making my point. You can use a computer to generate a ballot.
Yeah.
And that particularly works for, you know, disabled people and the blind and whatnot. But it's a paper ballot.
Yeah. And we need to practice preventive voting. We need not to be able to detect errors after we suspect they happen. We need to prevent them to begin with.
Yeah.
We need a fully reproducible election. And preferably have the vote counted twice, have a double-entry bookkeeping system.
Yeah, I mean, it works for business. Why would it not? You know, in fact, the IRS requires it for business. Why not for votes?
But if people look up David Dill in voting, they'll get much of the information they need on Google.
You're right. Yeah, David Dill's a good guy. Okay.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. Good hearing from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. This is an issue that's not, you know, going to go away. And frankly, I think that we all need to be very active in speaking out in favor of open source software and paper ballots, regardless of how they're generated. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, indeed, Tom DeLay has been indicted. Be interesting to see what happens with the other grand jury that has been impaneled. This one, this grand jury in Texas, today was their final day that they could be looking into Tom DeLay. And so, you know, it was punt or get off the football field time sort of thing, and they had to do it. I mean, they did. They indicted Tom DeLay. But there's that other one out there that we still haven't heard from yet. And, you know, the George W. Bush, Karl Rove. You know, what's the deal with who outed the CIA agent, brought down Brewster Jennings, an entire CIA covert operation to smoke out terrorists? Somebody brought them down just for purely partisan political purposes. Somebody in the Bush White House, some traitor, some treasonous traitor, some senior administration official.
And I don't know if we're going to find out the senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration. And there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
So, doesn't have any idea. But now we know it's Karl Rove, who, by the way, is now in charge of rebuilding Louisiana. He's got $52 billion to pass out. I wonder who's going to get some of that money. Oh, my goodness. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Gary in Kansas. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
So one of the things that I've been wondering for a long time is this receipt, paper receipt, ballot, whatever you want to call it, whatever form they want to make it, why don't they have it generated, put it in a separate box, have it scanned, as you mentioned, and tallied by a totally separate entity, and compare the two for a reference check.
Yeah, that was my suggestion. In fact, have, you know, a mandated, you know, 1% of them will be randomly compared, for example. Yeah, absolutely. That they use a computer.
I don't see in something so incredibly important as this that the cost is significant.
No, it's not. It's not. It's a very straightforward thing. Just have the voting machine generate the ballot. Not a receipt, a ballot. It's generating the actual piece of paper that is the vote, and then you have that ballot scanned by another machine on running separate software, and in both cases, the software is open source. That is, it's programmed by we, the people. The software is maintained by employees of us, employees of the government. And it's open to everybody. Everybody, anybody can look at that software and make sure that it's absolutely bulletproof.
And then like they're doing right now, have the machines tally the thing just like they're doing right now. At the end, you have two separate verifiable sources. And if there's a dispute, you have the original ballots you can come back to and cross-check and recount.
Yeah, Gary, I got to tell you,
so obvious.
The problem is you're making sense. You're making sense. And, you know, the Republicans, they just will not allow that. You can't be making sense, Gary.
Like you say, we have to call our county clerk's offices and hound them.
Yeah.
For this to happen.
Yeah, and
this is a simple answer. That's all there is to it.
Yeah, and you need to call your local election officials. And if you're not sure, you look in the phone book for your county clerk's office or call your state secretary of state's office as well in the state capitol wherever you're located. Because that's where the rubber meets the road on this thing.
Everybody listening to this program should be calling and like you say, calling repeatedly, not just once, but calling and asking for a reply,
yeah.
A written reply of what they're doing to solve this problem.
Yeah, well said.
Hey, thank you.
Gary, thanks a lot. I appreciate it, and thank you for listening to us there in Kansas. Alec DeBrow is with us. Alec is the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCAonline.org is the website. And, Alec, what's this about Weight Watchers in South Africa?
You're close. It's below the equator, but it's Australia.
Oh, okay.
Weight Watchers, it turns out, Weight Watchers, a very good organization, helped me lose 30 pounds, maybe, I guess in Australia, 12 kilograms, but the truth is it's also a $5.5 billion corporation, and they use, in various parts of this country and around the world, Weight Watchers International, they use volunteer labor or very low-paid labor. Well, the Australians, who are a bit more militant than we, decided this wouldn't do. So they joined the Liquor, Hospitality, and Miscellaneous Workers Union, took it to the Australian Industrial Relations Commission, and won. And they increased their base pay for each meeting from $28 Australian to $46.17. These were the paid people. And
because it's a for-profit company. It's unlike AA, for example, which is a totally voluntary thing.
Yeah, although there are no professional people in that whatsoever.
Well, actually, AA does have some sort of a superstructure or infrastructure because they do have
a
big annual meeting of some kind. I'm not an AA member, so I'm not real conversant in all this stuff, but I have several friends who are, and
mm-hmm.
it's a whole subculture. But in addition to the subculture, there is a nonprofit entity that does something with regard to AA, but with I think OA, you know, Overeaters Anonymous, and some of these others, they're nonprofits. But Weight Watchers is a private for-profit corporation. So their employees were being used as if they were in Australia, as if they were sort of like AA volunteers. And the workers in Australia said, no, hey, wait a minute, you guys are making some bucks off this thing, you're stockholders, so we should be paid a union wage.
Yep,
that's
fascinating. They were sort of permanent interns, and they got tired of it, is what the story was there.
Yeah.
Any
idea what it's like here in the United States?
In terms of pay?
With Weight Watchers and other programs like that?
I do know that I'm pretty sure the same regime holds that for setup and moving around, stuff like that, they're volunteer. I think people get a small stipend for sitting in at meetings and weighing people and stuff like that.
I
haven't really looked into it. But.
You know, I remember, Alec, when I was a kid, I grew up in Michigan, and the hospitals in Lansing, in the city that I grew up in, were all, I believe by law, required to be publicly owned hospitals. And there was, you know, the Ingham County Hospital is owned by the county. There was another, mm-hmm. they were all nonprofit organizations.
That's correct.
And as such, there were people. In fact, a friend of mine's mother or grandmother, his grandmother, was a candy striper.
They were everywhere.
Yeah, and these sometimes little old ladies, sometimes younger people who would volunteer, and they'd volunteer to work in the hospital. And it was a nonprofit organization, and there was something very noble about volunteering to work in the hospital. And when the laws changed, and those hospitals started being sold to private for-profit corporations like HCA, like Bill Frist's family company that performs abortions in hospitals all across the United States. In fact, Bill Frist's company, probably the largest provider of abortions in the United States, is something that needs to be said more often, I think. In any case, when they started being acquired by these very large multi-billion-dollar for-profit corporations, they still have volunteers. You know, you walk in and there's volunteers in the front. And I remember years ago thinking, why would you volunteer to work for a for-profit company? I don't get it. I mean, I still, you know, there are still people, you know, it's a noble thing working in a hospital, but there's something missing here.
Reminds me of the old SCTV show. There was this woman who proudly announced herself as a volunteer in a real estate agency. It strikes me as it's pretty much the same thing.
Yeah. So anyhow, we only have a couple minutes left here. What else is going on? The Change to Win Coalition?
Yeah, I just want to back up on this Davis-Bacon thing.
Yes, sir.
Something very interesting. I got after I did the show last week, I got a call from a laborer in Illinois who occasionally does a radio show there, or works on a radio show, a labor radio show. And he pointed out to me that we were bandying about this figure of $9.55 as the prevailing wage.
Yeah, now that's actually just for unskilled laborers. It actually goes as high as like $15 or $18 an hour.
No,
for certain
I
types
even
of
got
labor.
22. Yeah. I got the stuff, $22.06 in fringes. So
yeah.
When they're cutting money, and you're talking about Karl Rove's $52 billion, they want to make sure that all goes right into management, and not very much of it goes to workers.
Right. We're seeing class warfare in this country being conducted in a way that we haven't seen in the United States since the Gilded Age, since the robber barons.
Pretty much. It's so blatant.
Got a half a minute left here, Alec. A Change to Win Coalition. You got a meeting coming up?
Yes, indeed. The interesting thing, there was no coverage. The New York Times did a piece, and I haven't seen anything else. It's a done deal, 7 unions, and there's rumors of more. And what's different about them, it seems to be, at least their avowed intentions, are, one, their organizing goals. They're going to be huge. They're going to be sectoral. They're going after big pieces here. They're talking about Home Depot. They're talking about Walmart. They're talking about hospital, hotels, DHL.
Yeah, this is basically the renegade unions who split off from the AFL-CIO.
Right.
And they're meeting on September 27th at the Grand Renaissance Grand Hotel in St. Louis.
Yep.
And is there a website for them yet?
Yeah, it's just changetowin.org.
Changetowin.org. Okay, great.
Right.
So people can find out more about that.
Right.
And if you want to learn more about any of these issues and anything that has to do with organized labor, check out ilcaonline.org, the International Labor Communications Association. Alec Dubrow, thanks for being with us, Alec.
Okay, Tom, take it easy.
Keep up the great work there with the International Labor Communications Association, ilca.org. The Tom Hartman radio program, 16 minutes past the hour. And yes, Tom DeLay was indicted.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So do it for your children, do it for your wives, do it for future generations, do it for your life.
Welcome back, my friends.
Well, we've come so far, we can't stop now, we know which road to choose. And when we stand together, boys, you know that we can never lose.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. Scotty McClellan going through the grilling.
He had warned the president, warned the White House about the fact that this is going to be a, quote, bad one. And also suggested
that. Yes. And we have Ellen Ratner with us on the line, too. Hey, Ellen.
Some of them were not answered in the timeline that was requested.
So, Scotty, spinning there. It's all about Tom DeLay was just indicted. Our DeLay.
Now, the DeLay Political Death Watch.
I'll hand that one off to you, Ellen.
Well, thank you. Actually, this morning when I was at the gaggle at the White House, Tom, we allowed, as this probably was the worst performance that that Scott McClellan had ever done. I mean, he was just not on his game today, even as a spinner. So,
With regard to Tom DeLay?
No, with regard to FEMA, with regard to everything.
Oh, so, Michael Brown having committed perjury yesterday before the United States House of Representatives?
He couldn't come up with an answer except that the president wants people to look forward. I mean, it was about as bad as it gets.
Wow. That's refreshing to hear.
I mean, yeah, frankly, it could have been from a Saturday Night Live skit. That's how bad it was.
Wow. Amazing.
Okay,
yeah.
Let's talk about delay and what it's going to mean. First of all, it means that he has to step down, at least, quote unquote, as he's saying, temporarily. It looks as if that Roy Blunt was going to, people thought he was going to take over most of the responsibilities, but then Hastert said that he's going to recommend that David Dreyer of California step up into those duties, and then some would be given probably to Roy Blunt, who's the GOP whip, but basically they have to get the rank and file, and they may meet as early as tonight to go on Denny Hastert's recommendations. Now, as you know, other people have been indicted from this Trump PAC, which is Texans for Republican Majority Political Action Committee. And if he is convicted, he will, in fact, he can get up to 2 years in prison. What is also interesting about this is that what we're finding is that he's going after Ronnie Earle, who I actually know. Ronnie Earle is
the district attorney in what county is it?
It's in Austin, Texas, but in Austin, Texas, the county prosecutor actually prosecutes all of the state officials also. That's how the law is written in Texas. So it didn't have to happen in the county, but if they're a state official or something in that area, then that goes automatically to Ronnie Earle. He's been there. Ronnie Earle's been there at least 20 years, I think.
Yeah, he's prosecuted more Democrats than Republicans, in fact.
That's exactly what I was just going to say, that if he's saying, well, this is just this is just political, it's absolutely not true, because he has gone after more Democrats and has prosecuted more Democrats than he has Republicans.
Yeah, very straightforward. Okay. Ellen Ratner, thanks a lot for the report today.
You're welcome.
Amazing stuff. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. And, on we go, right? 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And David in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, you've been playing some incredible music coming back on all the breaks. But
well, thank you.
Thank
Louise, actually, who pulls all that stuff together.
Incredible. Wow. So to address really quickly the voter disenfranchisement issue, why hasn't Congress at this point passed some kind of an emergency election bill guaranteeing and protecting every American's right to vote? They've had 5 years to do it.
Yeah, I think they haven't, because there are large swaths of Congress who are not interested in democracy. They're interested in a corporate, owned and run aristocracy, elite, oligarchy, whatever. And the will of the people is not the first order of business when it comes to Republicans. Never has been, really. Well, actually, arguably it was from 1856 when the party was formed until 1872, the last party convention where they actually had a progressive platform. By 1873, the Republican Party had disintegrated into being the front, the shill for the railroad corporations, the early robber barons, and the progressives and the populace had split off, formed the Grange, formed the progressive movement, gone on their own, and that was the end of the Republican Party as a progressive movement, and then it became basically the corporate party and has been ever since.
Wow. So by hook or by crook, these rogue political parties, such as the one posing as a Republican Party right now, will continue to steal elections at the local, state, federal levels, with the help of the network media whores such as Fox News or CNN.
We've
got to change that.
That's my diagnosis, David, and very well said. And I agree. We do have to change it. And I thank you for calling. But I'm right there with you. It's something that we need to change. We need to change very quickly, in fact, because If we don't, I mean, how can you get people to participate in electoral politics when they don't think that their vote is going to be counted, when they don't think that their vote matters? How can you get people to show up? It's getting more and more difficult. It used to be people would say, it's all, you know, smoke-filled rooms. It's all politicians. They're all the same. Now you get some actual progressives out there, some people who are really trying to shake things up. And frankly, my suspicion is that in this 2006 election, and definitely the 2008 election, there's actually going to be good Republicans running as well as good Democrats running. That is, people who are actually interested in governance and reform, some Eisenhower Republicans. And, you know, now people are going to say, well, my vote doesn't count because of the machines. Now, we need to clean this up stuff. Now, 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 34 minutes after the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the daily memo from Roger Ailes. In fact, speaking of which, our piggies alert is
£291 billion, Dr. Calculus.
Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the...
Refuse.
Yeah, refuse. Yes. Per every day, and by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of...
Manure?
Manure, yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every 4 and 3, you've got a pile of this,
excrement.
Yeah.
Have you seen the big piggies in the starched white shed? You will find...
Yeah, those bigger piggies in their starched white shirts. Kind of swift boating the truth. You know, people call and they say, how is it that Republicans actually believe all this stuff? For example, Cindy Sheehan, she says, you know, that she's talking about Iraq. And she says, this, she's speaking of Iraq. She says, this country is not worth dying for, Iraq. And so Michelle Malkin takes that one little sentence out of context and says, oh, Cindy Sheehan, she's talking about America. And so then it gets into the hands of the right-wing spin machine, and then you get, you know, after the demonstration, you know, somewhere between a third and a half a million people show up in Washington, D.C. last weekend. Of course, you know, virtually no coverage in the media, of course. And you get Hannity on his TV program.
Well, that's pretty much what Cindy Sheehan has been saying. America's not worth dying for, that it's been taken over by thugs. America without the internet would be a fascist state. Are you willing to align yourself with all that radical extremism?
Well, good evening, Sean. I saw kind of a different protest out there. There were a lot of things going on.
What? You're going to speak well?
It really affected me to see so many Iraq veterans out there marching in front of the White House.
Well, we can't let this go on.
Talking about their experiences and why
gotta stop
they're
this conversation.
Disillusioned with this policy.
Ted, you know, I honestly, I'm not really, I don't care about your thoughts. You can tell them to Alan. I'm not asking you.
So, you know, that's part of it, is how it happens. Pretty straightforward process. Here's another one. At the university in Salt Lake City, Michael Moore, he has a speaker's fee. You know, a lot of big name folks like Michael Moore, he's on the A-list. If you want him to show up, you have to pay. And because that's how they make their living. And truth be told, it's also a fairly reasonable filter. It's a way of knowing that somebody's actually serious, that they're going to be able to put the thing together. Michael Moore's speaking fee is $40,000, apparently. And so Sean Hannity says, well, he's going to go out there and he's going to Hannitize the place, right? He's going to go out there and he's going to do his little gig first, and he's not going to charge a penny. Of course, Fox is paying him, what, millions? But he's not going to charge a penny. However, Sean won't travel on commercial airplanes. He only travels on his own private jet. And to fly out to Salt Lake City costs about $50,000 for his private jet. and first-class hotel accommodations and the limousine and all that stuff, $50,000. And but Hannity says, but you're not going to pay me a penny, so none of the student money is going to go to Sean Hannity. No, it's just going to cover his travel. And then somebody tries to confront him about it, and at the end of this clip, listen to what happens when Sean Hannity's, apparently Sean Hannity's, whoever it was, bodyguards get a hold of this guy. Here's the, this is first the setup from the local show.
Conservative Hannity is here to preempt a liberal Moore who's here in 9 days.
UVSC is paying Michael Moore a $40,000 speaking fee, but UVSC and donors will have to cover Hannity's travel expenses, which is several thousand dollars.
So then somebody confronts Hannity, asks him about it.
Sean, I'm from BYU, Brigham Young University, Stadium of Fire, big fan of you.
I'm very aware of you.
Is it true that we spent almost $50,000 on your travel expenses?
No, I don't think that's true. But I will say this. Before I came here, I made sure that not one penny would come out of student funds at the end of the day between ticket sales and donations from people that wanted me to come. And I'm not making a penny. And so unlike Michael Moore, I think was making $40,000 or $50,000 or something like that.
Guys,
yeah, but isn't it true?
Thanks, Sean.
Hey.
And off he goes. You know, it's like, off to the free speech zone. After all, that's the Republican way. Send them to the free speech zones. Yes, indeed. Steve in Ohio. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better. Especially now that Tom DeLay's been indicted. I'm just waiting for the for Fitzgerald's grand jury to come down. So.
Tit for tat. We got Ross Kentucky. You get Tom DeLay.
Oh, we?
Tit for tat.
Okay. was Dan Rostenkowski indicted?
I don't know, but he got kicked out of office.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm trying to hand you an olive leaf, right? And I don't like I don't like Sean Hannity's interviewing style. I thought he was kind of rude. I listened to that show. I thought he was kind of rude to him. I don't like when he does that. I really don't. So let the guy talk. At least Alan, which who I'm a fan of. He lets people talk, I mean, but, anyway, well, let's go on to the, Davis-Bacon Act. You were talking about that. You know, I don't really see where that's going to have any effect because labor is going to be at such a premium in the next 5 to 10 years in New Orleans. It's going to be a moot point.
Yes and no. You know, Steve, you're probably right in the micro. There will be a lot of money coming into that area, and they'll be sucking up a lot of labor. However, if the same companies that are rebuilding Iraq, who don't hire any local Iraqis, but bring people over from Texas, from all over the United States,
rebuilding New Orleans. Well, are you going to get contractors in the United States? My brother's in Florida, the Southeast in general. My brother's in Florida. He's a sub contractor. He does flooring, carpet tile, wood,
mm-hmm.
And he's working for a premium right now. I mean, his calendar's full. There's not enough hours in the day.
The same is true right here.
Even if you wanted to go out of New Orleans.
Steve, I get your point, and I agree with you. And right here in Portland, Oregon, for example, you know, to find somebody who's a skilled, you know, who has particular skills, you know, a skilled carpenter, a skilled plumber, you know, sometimes you have to pay a premium. Very often you have to pay a premium, in fact. There's a whole, you know, series of job categories that are becoming more and more, you know, harder to find people who are really good in that area. But if it is true that there is no need for Davis-Bacon because there will be such a shortage of labor that companies coming into that area will have to pay those prices anyway, then why would the Republicans push so hard to have Davis-Bacon done away with?
Some moron needs to be slapped.
Say what?
Some moron who came up with this needs to be slapped because you're causing the Republicans all sorts of headaches for nothing.
Yeah, okay. Okay, I'll go along with that.
I'll
go along with that. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. May well be. And we'll see. My guess, though, is that this is part of a nationwide assault on working people. That's the bottom line. I mean, what the Republicans are all about is protecting inherited wealth and corporate power and money, period. It's about the CEO class. It's about the robber barons. It's not about the average working person. And, you know, it's been repeated over and over and over again in their behaviors. It's just so conspicuous. So, of course, they don't like Davis-Bacon. And what we're talking about here is a national elimination of the middle class, a national turning America from a middle class nation with people who have actually a little leisure time and they can actually be politically active, turning them from that into basically the Charles Dickens world, you know, the Bob Cratchit, Mr. Scrooge, may I have a lump of coal, please? No, you may not. You may not. Get back to your desk. Mr. Scrooge, please, it's cold in here. My fingers, I can't hold the pen in here. No, you may not. Get back. Back into that world. I mean, that's the conservative paradise, right? Casey in Seattle, Washington, on line. Hey, Casey, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great. What's up, Casey?
Good morning. I am great. I just had a couple questions, but, okay, when you were talking about that Hannity guy, I just saw that show the other night.
You have my sympathy.
Oh, my gosh. No, I was like, what is this guy saying? And he had on, I even, like, took notes from it.
Yeah.
He had on Charlie Rangel.
Yeah, Charlie's a good guy. What you have to understand is that Fox is basically the propaganda arm of the Republican Party, period. And so everything is going to boil down to partisan politics on Fox News. Tragically, unfortunately. I have no problem, frankly, with media outlets that reveal their bias. Back when I was a kid, for example, in Detroit, there used to be the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News. The Detroit Free Press was the labor paper, and it was aligned with the AFL-CIO, and everybody knew that it was Democratic-leaning. The Detroit News was the Republican newspaper, and it had all the business news in it.
Right.
It had a business section. The Detroit Free Press had a labor section. Well, you know, during the Reagan era, the Detroit News got bought out by the Detroit Free Press, and boom, now there's only one paper, and they don't have a labor section anymore. That's what's happened in America. Yeah, you know, back in the old days, we used to have actually, you know, some balanced discourse in most of our cities. And because of the suspension of enforcement during the Reagan era of the Sherman Antitrust Act,
right,
now you have these monopolies that are controlling not just everything else, but the media as well. So we don't hear balanced stories.
Okay, I'm writing that down. But would he ever have you on the show?
Who, Sean Hannity?
Yeah.
God only knows. I'm...
It would be so great because he just totally tries to cut people off.
Well, that's
the thing. I was like yelling at the TV because I'm like, no, wait, say this. This is why, you know, the buses weren't used. And FEMA had said they weren't air conditioned. And I'm like, I wanted to be on there so bad.
But I got to tell you, Casey, the bottom line is, and it works, you know, it cuts both ways. But the bottom line is that whoever controls the board, whoever controls the show is always ultimately going to win. And so, you know, going on right-wing show, I used to do Michael Medved's show, another right-wing talk show host a lot. And it's funny because I could hear his producer telling him what to say in my ear. It's I'm coming in on the phone. Anyhow, Casey, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Just wanted to remind you, this weekend, coming up in Portland, Oregon, Friday through Sunday, September 30th through October 2nd, I will be speaking at a conference including Congressman Jesse Jackson, Jr., David Cobb, the Green Party candidate president for the United States in 2004. Bob Kohler, nationally syndicated columnist with Tribune Media Services. Ronnie Duggar, the founder of the Alliance for Democracy. Cliff Arnebeck of Ohio Honest Elections Campaign. Ellen Thiessen of Voters Unite. Paul Leto, an attorney and plaintiff in the lawsuit against Sequoia Voting Systems. And Brad Friedman of the Brad Blog, radio talk show host. We will all be speaking at a national summit nationwide to save our elections, a call to rescue our democracy. If you'd like more information on that, you can go to the website OregonVRC, as in voting, Voters Rights Coalition, OregonVRC.org, and you can get all the information there. The specific page is for this is actually summit.OregonVRC.org, but there it is, so check it out. You know, I haven't yet talked about what I thought was the biggest story of the day, and somehow the show just, you know, sometimes things just get away from you. But I wanted to start out with pointing out that yesterday, Michael Brown, before the United States House of Representatives, in under oath, committed perjury. He lied under oath. I mean, he came out and he said, if you check the documentation, and this is no secret. I mean, this is all over the internet. Go to thinkprogress.org if you want, you know, one of the tightest, cleanest, most concise summaries of this with the links to the actual documents. Kathleen Blanco, the governor of Louisiana, asked George W. Bush for federal aid, specifically for FEMA, you know, specifically for help, including the counties, the three counties that make up the city of New Orleans. And when Bush issued his proclamation, those three counties were missing. They were missing. They were also the Democratic counties. And there are a lot of folks who are scratching their heads going, why is it that the counties that vote Democratic were not included in Bush's proclamation and the counties that actually voted for Bush in 2004 were included in his resolution? Could he be that slimy? Well, I don't have the answer to that question, frankly, because nobody knows why. But what Michael Brown did was he tried to flip it around. He tried to say that, and in fact, Stephen Beyer, the Republican from Indiana, this Republican hack that they've brought into to eviscerate the Veterans Committee, Veterans Affairs Committee, at the behest of Tom DeLay. Stephen Beyer just handing these lines to Michael Brown, essentially saying, those three counties, those weren't included because the governor didn't want to include them, right? And Brown going, yeah, it was the governor. It wasn't the president, it was the governor. When in fact, if you, as I said, go to thinkprogress.org, there's a link right to the governor's letter, which includes Orleans Parish, you know, the three parishes, the three counties that make up New Orleans. This is the testimony yesterday before Congress.
So as I'd like to know, why did the president's Federal Emergency Assistance Declaration of August 27th not include the parishes of Orleans, Jefferson, and Plaquemine?
That's Stephen Beyer, and here's Michael Brown.
Under the law, the governor makes the request for the declaration, and the governors of the states specify what areas, what counties they want included in that declaration. And based upon the governor's request, that's the recommendation that we make to the president.
And it's a lie.
So if a governor does not request a particular county or a particular parish, that's not included in the request.
Right. Orleans Parish is New Orleans. I was listening to my colleague, Mr. Jefferson's questions when he talked about, well, you know, they asked for this assistance 3 days, and the president responded the very next day, not the day that was made request. But the governor of Louisiana actually excluded New Orleans from the president's Federal Emergency Assistance Declaration?
Again, Congressman, we look at the requests. The governors make the request in writing.
Let me ask this. Since you went through the exercise, Pam, was that not shocking to you that the governor would exclude New Orleans from the declaration?
Yes.
Came in excluding these three parishes, did you question it?
We questioned it, but I made the decision that we were going to go ahead and move assets in regardless.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that mind-boggling? This is absolutely incredible. And you look at the and the governor came out, you know, yesterday, and she said, you know, sorry, but this is not the truth. What this guy is saying, it's just simply not the truth. This is what Blanco said. Mike Brown testified today under oath, this is yesterday afternoon, that I did not include Orleans, Jefferson, and Plaquemine parishes in my original disaster declaration request sent to the president on August 28th. In fact, that request did include 14 parishes in southeast Louisiana, including Orleans, Jefferson, and Plaquemine. Mr. Brown further suggested that I did not order an evacuation of New Orleans until Sunday, August 28th. In fact, the evacuation was ordered on the morning of Saturday, August 27th. Within 48 hours, 1.3 million citizens, representing more than 90% of the region, were safely evacuated in the state's extraordinarily effective evacuation plan that included early use of contraflow on the interstate systems, which, by the way, they didn't do in Texas. Remember, we were watching on TV. Such falsehoods, says Blanco, and misleading statements made under oath before Congress are shocking. It further demonstrates, or clearly demonstrates, the appalling degree to which Mr. Brown is either out of touch with the truth or reality. Kathleen Blanco striking back. And you can read the document, the White House document. You know, Franklin County, Grant County, Jackson County, next in alphabetically should be Jefferson, but no, they jump right over that to LaSalle. And then Nichitonis County, the next one should be Orleans and Plaquemines. They're not there. It goes right to Point Coupe. They just omitted them. Whereas you read the governor's letter, And she says, parishes expected to receive major damage, blah, 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 include Jefferson, Orleans, Plaquemines, Bernard, St. Charles. And there's, it's right there. So why is this guy not in handcuffs? Michael Brown yesterday, perjury before the United States House of Representatives. Call your member of Congress and give him your mind on that one.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Check
www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Pat Tillman. It seems the, you know, we keep getting, well, here's the whole story. It's finally coming out. Well, he was killed by friendly fire. That story finally came out. His parents are really upset. Well, that story finally came out. This is the guy, the NFL football star who passed up a multi-million dollar contract to become an Army Ranger. Turns out, Pat Tillman was opposed to the war in Iraq. In fact, he called the invasion so effing illegal. Tillman joined the Army specifically to fight Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And he said he was sent to participate in the invasion of Iraq against his wishes. He was an avid reader and fan of Noam Chomsky. He was scheduled to meet Chomsky when he returned from Afghanistan. He said he planned to vote for John Kerry. It was pretty amazing. This is all from the San Francisco Chronicle. They just got a hold of 2,000 pages of testimony on his death and interviewed his family and soldiers who served with him. And what they find is that Tillman has been completely reinvented by the Reich. It's just incredible. The whole Reich wing spin. He was a noble guy. He was gung-ho for George W. Bush. No. After 9/11, he was horrified that Al-Qaeda would do that, and he wanted to go fight against Osama bin Laden. But, you know, George Bush, Osama bin Laden, you know, after all, it was Osama bin Laden's half-brother, Salim bin Laden, who bailed George Bush's first company, Arbusto Oil Company, out when it was going down the tubes. And then when, you know, when they started investigating the whole deal, Salim bin Laden died mysteriously in a plane crash in Texas, a small plane that, you know, sort of like Mel Carnahan and Paul Wellstone. And have you ever noticed that, and Bobby Kennedy and John Kennedy and Martin Luther King, have you ever noticed that conservatives seem not to die in these bizarre, and now I'm starting to get into the twilight zone here, but in any case, so Pat Tillman decided that he was going to go over. He wanted to fight against Osama bin Laden. And what's George Bush's thoughts on Osama bin Laden?
So I don't know where he is. Nor do, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him. I'll be honest with
you. Yeah, just don't spend that much time. I don't really care. You know, don't know where he is. But Pat Tillman was concerned about that. So anyhow, that on we go. Right? FEMA now. The president comes out and says this was a story in the Washington Post, front page story in the Washington Post yesterday about how FEMA is planning to reimburse faith groups. This phrase, faith groups, has come to replace, you know, churches, synagogues, mosques, religious organizations, faith groups, well, whatever. Anyhow, they plan to reimburse faith groups for Katrina aid. And there's a lot of faith groups with their hand out right now. Now, you'll recall when Hurricane Katrina was happening and people all across America were watching these TV photos of people drowning and dying and begging for help, and nothing was coming to help them because Michael Brown was busy and George Bush was busy, you know, that when people were watching these horrific photos, their hearts were bursting. People just wanted to help in some way, and so they went to the FEMA website at FEMA.gov, and there was a link right on the homepage, and it said, click here to donate money. And you click on that link, and it took you to a website that said, here's three organizations that will accept cash, and it was the Red Cross and a food bank, a fairly good one, and Pat Robertson. Pat Robertson's Operation Blessing. This was the Bush administration's payback to Pat for trying to politically assassinate Hugo Chavez down in Venezuela. FEMA officials. So anyhow, as time went on and it became a kind of a growing scandal that Pat's website was there. Pat, whose Operation Blessing has been outed for the planes that are paid for with donations, are actually helping ferry workers and supplies to the diamond mines in Africa that Pat Robertson owns, along with Mr. Taylor, Charles Taylor, in Liberia, these blood diamonds that the billionaire Pat Robertson owns. So anyhow, as that started coming out, they took Pat Robertson off the page, and they put up a whole bunch of other religious organizations. There's just a whole mess of religious organizations there on the FEMA website, because they don't want to support secular organizations. Heaven forbid, people might do good just because they want to do good. No, we want people to do good because they want to proselytize. And here, FEMA officials, this is Jack Becker, Senior Vice President for Preparedness and Response with the Red Cross. He says, I believe it's appropriate for the federal government to assist the faith community because of the scale and scope of the effort and how long it's lasting. So you get the Red Cross getting in the act. Yes, let's give federal money to churches. Keep in mind, the first president of the United States who was presented with an opportunity or an option, who was presented with, shall we give federal money to churches or not, was James Madison. It was in 1811 or 1812. And Congress passed a bill requisitioning money to give to a church in Washington, D.C., that was running in the back of the church, that was running a place where poor people, homeless people could sleep, and a food kitchen. And the bill came before James Madison, President of the United States, and it was his first presidential veto. He vetoed it. And in his veto message to Congress, he expressed his concern that if federal money ever started being given to churches, that it would corrupt the mission of churches. James Madison, a fairly spiritual guy, was very concerned that the spiritual mission of churches would become corrupted if Caesar's money started getting thrown their way. Now, here's 40 pieces of silver for you. Jefferson, on the other hand, felt that churches should not be allowed to use their efforts, their energies, to influence government. Because Jefferson was afraid of the theocrats. He was afraid that the churches would try to corrupt the government. Madison didn't think that would happen. He thought the American people were too smart for that. After all, they'd lived through the Salem witch trials. They'd seen that happen here. They had seen the revolution in England back in the 18th century. They had seen that, and they said, enough. No, we don't want a theocracy. But what Madison was afraid of was that federal money would corrupt the churches. Reverend Barry Lynn, now president of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, he says, what frosts me about this, here is an administration that didn't do its job, and now it's trying to dig itself out by making right-wing groups happy. So the Bush administration saying, no, we want to give money to churches. We definitely want to give money to churches. And I got to say, there's a hero in this story. Yeah, our jolly good fellow for the day, Dr. Robert Record. He's the head of the Southern Baptist Disaster Relief Effort. Yes, one of those faith-based groups. And Dr. Record says, And I quote, volunteer labor is just that, volunteer. We would never ask the government to pay for it. He doesn't want any of that stinking government money. He says the Southern Baptists, when they put together their disaster relief organization, which, by the way, is the third largest disaster relief agency in the United States, they have already provided 5 million hot meals and vital services to Katrina victims alone. They said, nope, we don't want any of that federal money. On the other hand, you got groups like, you know, Billy Graham's group, who are out there passing out Bibles to people with money that's coming from, you know, these faith-based groups. You've got, yeah, several of these, many of these groups, now they're saying, yeah, here, have a meal and have a religious tract. Have a meal, and but you got to pray first. Have a meal, but join our church. And Franklin Graham, Billy Graham's son, is saying, you know, this is how it's supposed to be. The government gives us money. We use that money to feed people. And while we're feeding them, we tell them, you got to join our church. But the Southern Baptists say, nope, no thank you. We do it because Jesus told us to. Not to grow our membership. Good on them. Good on them. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. And Dick in Seattle, Washington, on the line. Hey, Dick, what's up?
Yeah, good morning, Tom. Back to the election issue here. You know, if we're going to stop the Republican theft of our elections at the ballot, I think that the two issues we have to fix to regain our democracy are an automatic recount if the count doesn't correspond to a good mandated exit poll oversight, and also, of course, an open source code system that's safe from hacking at the vote count tabulator where it's being done.
Yeah, you're the first person who has suggested, although I have in my op-eds for Common Dreams, suggested that we should have exit polls as an important part of our election system.
It's our only protection.
Well, and in fact, the chairman of the Republican National Committee after the 2004 election came out and said, Ed Gillespie, the former Enron lobbyist and RNC chairman, came out and said that there should be no more exit polls. That ever since 2000, the exit polls had all showed that the Republicans lost, but in fact, the electronic machine said that the Republicans won in the 2000 election, the 2002 election, and the 2004 election. And he thought that this was dispiriting Republicans, and therefore there should not be exit polls any longer.
Well, what's going on now with the Republicans hacking the vote is clearly has to be one of the worst crimes you can commit against a democracy, you know, but it's being covered up by our corporate pretend media, you know, it, right here in our own gubernatorial election, the Republicans almost stole the election by hacking the vote in a big Democratic county north of Seattle. It's now in litigation. It's not being covered, but it's completely ignored. And all the liberal media would focus on was Seattle's big King County always heavily Democrat. There was no election fraud there, but where there was, not a word.
Yeah, well, the point that I've been... Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Dick. It's a good point. And the point that I've been making over and over again is that we have sponsored this elsewhere. In Serbia, there was this group of half a dozen guys. I believe it was five. It might have been seven. I wrote a piece about it called How to Take Back an Election. If you go to TomHartman.com and click Articles on Democracy, you'll find it right toward the top there. And these guys in Serbia, what they did was they helped unwind a stolen election. And they did it so well that the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, Freedom House, which is started by Eleanor Roosevelt, and the U.S. Department of State all helped fund them and took these guys into They had done it in Serbia, took them into the Ukraine, took them into Belarus, and took them into Soviet Georgia during the elections in those three countries. And in each one of those countries, you had a media that was controlled by the machine, that was controlled by the party in power. You had a party in power that was absolutely set on stealing elections. And so what they did, for example, in the Ukraine, the one that everybody in America knows, the Orange Revolution, right? What they did was they came up with a logo. The logo was a ticking clock. They came up with a slogan. The slogan was, "His time is up." They came up with a brand. It was a color. It was orange. And then they organized exit polls. And to organize the exit polls, they got the participation of the Organization for Cooperation and Unity in Europe. And they got the cooperation of Jimmy Carter and the Carter Center. They had several credible groups, the United Nations, several credible groups working together on these exit polls. And then the problem was, what do you do if the exit poll shows that the good guy won, but the bad guy has stolen the vote? And so he comes out and says, "Hey, I won." Just like in the United States, the exit polls at the end of the night on November 2nd, 2004, showed that John Kerry had won, even in Ohio. But the electronic voting machines didn't show that. So what do you do? Well, what they did in the Ukraine was, as soon as the exit polls were completed, within minutes of the closing of the ballots, of the closing of the elections, they publicized it from one end of the country to the other. So they got the story out there first. And that made it almost impossible for the mainstream media and the corrupt party in power to say, no, ignore those exit polls. They're mistaken. We actually won. And they were successful in doing that in Serbia. They were successful in doing that in the Ukraine. They were successful in doing that in Belarus. And the only country where they failed was in Soviet Georgia. Or maybe I've got it. No, it's the other way around. They failed in Belarus and they succeeded in Georgia. And that's what I was suggesting. We need to do. We should be out there funding John Zogby or something. Let's get exit polls back in the United States and get them vital and make them real and part of the whole process and get them out there. And, you know, with exit polls, good, clean exit polls and using those as the canary in the mineshaft. I mean, I lived in Germany for a year back in the mid-80s. In Germany, you vote on a piece of paper. Your ballot is done by hand. And after you vote, it takes 4 days to count the vote because they just take civil servants. They just take people from their regular jobs. You're working at the Department of Motor Vehicles, and you have to take 4 days off to count the vote. And so government just kind of slows down for 4 days. And everybody is counting the vote, all these government employees. They're all being observed by partisan folks from the various parties. But they know within 10 minutes of the time the polls close who won. Now, how can that be possible if it takes 4 days to count the vote? Because it's all on paper and it's all counted by hand. Well, they know within 10 minutes of the time the polls close who won the vote because the exit polls have never been more than 0.1% off in 30 years. And that's how it works in countries all over the world, except the United States. In fact, that's how it worked in the United States up until 1996. And then in 1998, the exit polls started going screwy. And in 2000, in 2002, 2004, the exit polls all show Democratic landslides all across the nation, but the Republicans were actually winning. How could that be? And why only in the United States? Why not in any other country in the world? Questions that nobody to this day has answered. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends.
Was sent to the Republican National Committee, where it was exchanged for money raised from individuals.
The indictment of Tom DeLay.
And then sent to those Texas legislative candidates.
It's Ronnie Earle.
Criminal conspiracy is a state jail felony punishable by 6 months to 2 years in the state jail and a fine of up to $10,000. Thus far in this investigation that began following the November 2002 Texas state elections, there have been 41 indictments carrying a total of 81 counts returned. The Texas Association of Business, Texans for Republican Majority Political Action Committee, 8 corporations, and 4 individuals have been indicted. 4 of those cases have been resolved.
This is not just Tom DeLay.
Be happy to answer any questions.
There you go. This is the press conference that Ronnie Earle is holding in in Texas about the indictment of Tom DeLay. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Mark in St. Petersburg, Florida on the line. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Tom, thanks for keeping people informed out there.
I'm doing my best, Mark. There's so much coming through here.
It's incredible. That's for sure. You know, why did they keep Tom DeLay for as long as they did? We knew he was a crook a long time ago.
Well, here's where it gets scary, Mark, and that is that Denny Hastert is going to replace Tom DeLay with David Dreyer. David Dreyer is, you know, some people kind of dismiss him as, oh, he's this metrosexual guy, you know, he's Mr. No Hair Out of Place, he's, you know, whatnot. And what they mistake is that David Dreyer is the guy who was behind Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's the one who made Schwarzenegger governor. David Dreyer is a very, very powerful, very competent, very smart politician. And he's also probably, in all probability, from everything I've been able to see over the years, and I've been watching this guy for a couple of years now, he's probably clean. That is to say, he's not doing the old-fashioned corruption stuff that Tom DeLay did. Instead, he's simply a tool of the fascist machine. He's the clean, pretty face of the fascist machine rather than the dirty, grubby face. And so, in a way, you know, we've lost the cartoon character that everybody loves to hate. We've lost, you know, this generation's Newt Gingrich is gone and has been replaced by somebody who I think, frankly, for democracy in the United States is more dangerous.
Bunch of goose steppers. You know, we have something in common with the right wing, and that is that we don't want an oppressive government. We want our constitutional republic back, and we want these federal employees and these soldiers and sailors to honor that oath that they took to protect our Constitution.
Well, that's what we have in common with true Republicans and true conservatives. But I'm telling you, not with these guys in the White House right now, and not with these guys in Congress.
We have corporatist, federalist, imperialists who say that they are Republicans. They are not. We are Democratic Republicans just like Thomas Jefferson was.
There you go.
And what was he up against? Adams, a bunch of elitists that wanted a king. And that's what we've got right now, a king. As a matter of fact, these people are following that king so much in lockstep that they wrote him a blank check that enabled him to illegally invade a sovereign country.
Yeah.
Just say no to fascism. I have free bumper stickers at my website, justsaynotofascism.com.
Okay,
justsaynotofascism.com.
Good one.
Hold signs up, wear shirts, hats. We need to talk to our coworkers, our neighbors. Get the word out.
There you go. Mark, thanks a lot for the call and for sharing that. Justsaynotofascism.com. I love it.
I thought What Would Jefferson Do was awesome.
My book. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for your kind words, Mark, and good luck with your website. Keep up the great work. You know, the funny thing is, Mark says that George is our king. We fought a revolution against the third George to be king of England, King George III. He was the son of King George II, who had ruled England just before him, and then George I was way back before that. In the United States, we now have a third George to be president, who is the son of the second George to be president. And the first George is way back a long time ago. Isn't that ironic? Keith in Kent, Washington. Hey, Keith, what's on your mind today?
Hey, morning, Tom. Hey, I have a website, too, but it just has pictures of my wife and baby on it. Hey,
okay.
You know, the funny thing is, the first thing out of the White House, Scott McClellan this morning, was Tom DeLay is an ally. And that is a soundbite that the Democrats should use over and over. An indicted potential criminal has been stated this morning as an ally of our president and his administration. The same thing with so many issues. We need a pit bull mentality. I am still willing to work within the system, but I believe that Pelosi and others should be calling a spade a spade.
Well, they are. I'm telling you, I've got in my hand here right now, I'm holding a news release on behalf of Senate Democratic Leader Harry Reid. This is from the Senate Democratic Communications Center. The headline in big letters, "The Bush Administration, a culture of cronyism and corruption." And this from Harry Reid. "In the Bush administration, it's not know-how, it's know-who, partisan politics, Trump's practical experience." They go through a list of all these people who are in different organizations. Michael Brown at FEMA, David Safavian at OMB, Joseph Schmitz in the Pentagon, Scott Gottlieb at the FDA, Halliburton and the Shaw Group and all these things. Frederick Black, he's reassigned after investigating Abramoff. Lawrence Greenfield. in the Bush, Bunny Greenhouse, Colleen Rowley, folks who have been damaged by this, the whistleblowers who have paid the price by the Bush administration. This is absolutely, you know, nailing these guys right, I mean, right hard. And in fact, it's the next thing in my pile of things to get to here on the program. And I guarantee you, it's being ignored by the mainstream media. You've got Howard Dean out there speaking out and speaking loud. Nobody is paying attention to him, and the mainstream
and more
media
power,
is ignoring.
More power to these people. I believe that maybe the day is coming where we all need to wear some type of emblem. You talked about the Ukraine with the orange. We need to wear some type of identifying mark that we are dissenting, and our dissent will not be marginalized, period.
Yeah. There you go. And
thank you so much for your good work, Tom.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you, Keith. And in my opinion, I keep coming back to this meeting that I spoke at in Portland, Oregon a week or two ago, and it was about the vote being corrupted. After the presentation, this woman gets up, and, you know, it was a question and answer period. This woman gets up and she says, those Democrats, they never stand up for us. And, why should we have any faith in those Democrats? And I'm like, you know, what do you think it's going to take to make them stand up? And she says, I don't know. I think we ought to just give up. I said, have you ever been to a meeting? Have you ever showed up for, you know, like your county Democratic Party meeting? No. Have you ever even sent them $10? No. Have you ever written a letter to any of them? No. Well, that's why they're those Democrats. We need to make them us Democrats and us Republicans and us Greens. I mean, you know, get involved, get active. I just can't say it enough. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to let you know I called two congressmen and I called the three main TV stations in Pittsburgh today about the mercenaries down in New Orleans.
What kind of feedback did you get?
They didn't know anything about it. And I told the two congressmen's aides, which they weren't aware of it, I wanted a written reply back on what they're going to do about it. Because in my opinion, if these people were hired by private contractors, they are no different than hitmen on the street.
Yeah, yeah.
And if the confiscation of guns was taken off the survivors, which I call them, they're not criminals. They're U.S. American citizens that they were disarmed, and now they have the people, and on the internet last night, if there was a news media hotel banner somewhere, that these people went out to use their cell phones and had the guns pointed in their faces.
Yeah.
And, I think maybe that you're the only one that even mentioned anything about it. But what
you're
we
kidding.
Have to do, we have to alert the American people. I believe you go into 38 states, right?
Yeah, well, actually, we're
just
in type every state in the Union right now.
Okay, just type in Blackwater mercenaries and let them read it for yourself. It's so scary that I think that your First Amendment rights are going to be next.
Yeah.
Our
First Amendment rights. And
yes,
in fact, I would say under this Bush administration, our First Amendment rights have already been trampled because one of your First Amendment rights is the right to peaceably assemble to petition the government for redress of grievances. And you try petitioning the government
without a permit. Yeah.
Yeah. Or where Bush is giving some kind of campaign speech and, you know, they stick a gun in your face and say, you're going to the free speech zone down the road there with that place with the chain link fence and the barbed wire on the top. That's where you're going.
Well, I urge everybody to hear you, if they read that on the internet, the call to congressmen or senators.
Yeah.
We have a couple of wasteful ones like Santorum and Malicious Heart here. And
but that doesn't mean you don't call them. You still have.
Well, you know what? I have never gotten any reply from them. You know, as long as I am calling them, the two I went to this morning, I know.
But you still want to let them know that you're there, that, you know, we are still here. We're not going away. Just keep
they know we're here.
There you go. Jim, thanks a lot for the call, and keep up the great work. Jim, to another Jim in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Jim, we got a little less than a minute here left. What's up?
I understand that. How you doing, Tom? It's great to hear you. It's
Thank
my
you.
First time calling. I became aware recently of United States FBI agents going into Puerto Rico.
Yeah, and killing this activist leader.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he was 72 years old.
You know, I read that story, or I read a story about the story, actually. And
he was a national hero in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was advocate for Puerto Rico's independence.
Yeah, I can't speak to it right now. Let me do a little more research on that, Jim.
I'm just saying that's a really important story that has just not been covered anywhere.
Yeah, I haven't. You know, I've only seen it in a couple of places, and I really personally don't know enough about it to have a take on it. You know, and I need to do
they
a little homework on that.
They let him bleed to death in his house.
Well, let me check into that, and I'll get back with you on that.
Okay, Tom. But good luck.
Thanks for sensitizing me and for pointing that out to our listeners. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you, Jim. It's 45 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Truth and reason for a change. Fair and slightly unbalanced.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Oh, you tell him, Louie. Welcome back, my friends. 50 minutes past the hour, about 9 minutes, coming up on 9 minutes before the top of the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just checking out the story about the fellow that our caller was just talking about, Filiberto Ojeda Rios, a legendary figure, says the New York Times, an article by Abby Goodnow, with a violent past. He's 72 years old. He was gunned down by the FBI. Apparently, the head of the FBI has actually requested an internal investigation. Seems that the guy has been a leader of the independence movement in Puerto Rico for all of his life. Sometimes violent, sometimes felonious, sometimes just political. But the huge mistake, apparently, that the FBI made beyond just, you know, the assassination of somebody however it ends up spinning out, is that they killed him on the day which is the anniversary of the attempted revolution in 1868, an unsuccessful rebellion against Spanish rule by Puerto Rico. That was September 23rd, 1868. And so that was the day that this guy, who's a fighter for independence in Mr. Ojeda Rios, that's the day that the FBI killed him in Puerto Rico. And so it's got the Puerto Rican community, or it's got Puerto Rico, very, very upset about this. He had apparently jumped bail while awaiting trial for an armed robbery of a Wells Fargo depot in West Hartford, Connecticut, one of the biggest robberies in U.S. history. He was tried in absentia in 1992, sentenced to 55 years in prison, hiding out in Puerto Rico, and that's where the FBI found him and gunned him down. But it's a messy thing. Anyhow, that's the story on that, as much as I know of the story on that. We'll see how it plays out. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Diana in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Diana.
Hi. I wanted to speak to the idea of our Democratic leaders and that they're not speaking up as well as some people would like them to.
Mm-hmm.
I was at not the big demonstration last weekend, but I was at a demonstration to prevent drilling in the Arctic wildlife range.
Right.
On Tuesday. It was about a week ago Tuesday. And we had a lineup of speakers that was unbelievable. We had Lieberman, we had Kerry, we had Hillary Clinton, Dennis Kucinich, of course, and Robert Kennedy Jr., who's going to be in Grand Rapids tonight speaking. And they did not mince any words. They called the administration criminal. They demanded that they be thrown out. They listed crimes that they did. They were amazing, all of them.
Taking names and kicking butt. And I'll bet that your local media did not play any of those clips.
No, and the thing is, I think that the anti-war issue, people are still throwing things at Jane Fonda 50 years later. It's just too difficult for them, since they're from districts where people are dying and have died, to say, you know, to really come out strongly, because the people take it so personally. But when they get an issue that's a unifying issue, like drilling in a wildlife refuge, and if they can drill in a wildlife refuge, they can drill in your backyard.
True.
So it's coming up in the reconciliation bill. budget bill really soon. No filibuster, and down.
Right. I was going to say, the problem with that, those kind of bills is that you can't amend them, you can't change them. It's a yes or no vote, period, and it's going to be a crucial vote.
Right, and our Grand Rapids representative is pivotal. And so there's a lot of focus here on that issue. But you, those people, if we could get clips from any of our Democratic leaders, they were unbelievable. And they were very, very clear about what they thought this administration was doing and that they were all packing criminals.
Well said, Diana. The problem is not that the Democrats are not speaking out. The problem is that when they do speak out, it is not being covered by the corporate media in America. I mean, it's just that's just the bottom line. It's the liberal elite. I'm sorry. It's not. It never was, never has been, probably never will be. You know, as close as you can get to a liberal elite media is probably this program. And I'll cop to that. You know,
but the left should understand that they are some of them feel very constrained on the anti-war issue, but they are speaking out really clearly on other issues that are less divisive.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. Diana, thank you very much for the call. Mm-hmm. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Robert in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Robert.
Hi, Tom. I would like to suggest that you have Pat Tillman's parents on your show. I saw a couple of interviews with his father, and his father does not believe that his death was accidental.
No, you mean accidental friendly fire?
Right.
They assassinated Pat Tillman?
Well, I don't know if you're aware of this, but he was scheduled to meet with Noam Chomsky when he got back to the States. In fact, Tillman was very much against the Iraq War and apparently was getting ready to speak out. And since he was the highest-profile soldier in Afghanistan, he could have been a danger to the Bush administration's plans. I mean, I'm not saying that's what happened, but I think we need an investigation, not a Pentagon inside investigation, but I think we need a special prosecutor. You know, the man was a hero. He was a sports star. You know, why is it that, you know, he can just be killed and the Pentagon can lie?
Is Pat Tillman's father of the opinion that his son was assassinated to keep him from speaking out against the Bush administration?
During the interview, he basically was saying that he suspected that it was a fragging incident. He didn't use the word fragging, but you could tell that's what he was getting at. He wanted a real investigation.
Fragging is where soldiers kill their own.
Right, on purpose.
Yeah.
Not by accident.
Right, right.
And this is totally off the topic, but since you brought up David Dreyer, I didn't know if you'd heard about this, but a couple years ago when he was running Schwarzenegger's campaign in California, the media had done stories basically exposing that David Dreyer had been, you know, living with his chief of staff for years. And in fact, David Dreyer, who had voted for much of that anti-gay legislation from the Republican Party, David Dreyer was exposed as himself being gay by the local media in his congressional district.
Right, although now he has married. And has a baby, so it's, you know, it's one of those, it's another Republican hypocrite.
It's a question of hypocrisy. Yeah. The hypocrisy is just stunning with these Republicans.
It really and truly is. Robert, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. I appreciate it. We got to wrap up the show. Thanks for being with us today. We will see you tomorrow, same time, same place. Keep the faith, my friends. Keep the fight going.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.